Chapter 5. Under Construction, Love's Changing Role. For stony limits cannot hold love out, and what love can do, that dares love attempt. William Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet. Which kind of stupid are we? Once we have a grasp of love's dual nature, we can rethink the whole idea that biological and social theories of love are in competition with each other. Where did that sense of rivalry come from? Perhaps it's just that people love to sort themselves into binary categories, liberal or conservative, male or female, gay or straight. We do it even when the binaries obviously don't make much sense, cat person or dog person. This phenomenon has recently manifested in the form of coffee shop tip jars that come in pairs, offering customers a quick hit of binary choice, sun or rain, chocolate or vanilla. The mechanisms that prompt us to do this in all areas of life have probably also helped inculcate the idea that we have to choose, love is biology or love is society. The thing is, anytime we make such a choice, especially about something important, it's easy to begin to feel like part of an in-group, with those who make the other choice forming an out-group. This encumbers us with a temptation to demonstrate to ourselves and everyone else that our in-group is superior and the out-group is inferior. In fact, we can quickly become unreasonably resistant to any evidence to the contrary. I have no objection to leveraging this element of our psychology to secure tips for baristas, but I do worry when it seems to be hampering our efforts to understand a complex world. The appearance of competition between biological and social understandings of love weakens both enterprises. In efforts to prove the outgroup is inferior, social theorists of love can be dismissed as unscientific and uninformed, while biological theorists can be labeled unsophisticated or uncritical. Instead of learning from the insights of whichever group isn't our own, we simply write each other off as one or another kind of stupid. We must resist this temptation. We stand to learn far more about love if we do, especially when it comes to understanding how and why love changes over time. Appreciating that process of change requires appreciating how love's biological nature and its social role fit together, and what happens when they pull apart. Aliens versus 19th century lesbians. Imagine that on another planet, there is an alien society very much like contemporary North American society. It's replete with alien rom-coms, alien weddings, alien genders associated with distinct reproductive roles like ours, caring alien relationships, monogamous alien pair bonding for life as a cultural norm, and so on. In other words, imagine an alien culture that's constructed a social role for romantic love exactly like the one we have here and now. But suppose the biological machinery that makes up these aliens is completely different from ours. Instead of dopamine and oxytocin, the aliens might have no chemicals in their brains at all. Perhaps their heads are filled with a system of levers and pulleys, or perhaps they don't even have heads. The question is whether these aliens are capable of falling in love or not. If love is something in our biology, then we ought to say these aliens don't fall in love. They aren't made of the right biological stuff. Maybe they fall in something that looks like love, but to say they literally fall in love would be a bit like saying they have heart attacks just because they sometimes fall down, clutching the places where their hearts would be if they had hearts, which they don't. No hearts, no heart attacks. No brain chemistry, no romantic love, so says the biological theory. On the other hand, if love is a social construct, we should say the aliens do fall in love. They're doing everything right. They meet the one, care very deeply for that one, form a bond, build a life, get alien married, raise alien spawn together, and so on. Just as different actors can play Hamlet in different productions, different kinds of biological machinery can play the romantic love role in different creatures. Or so says the social constructionist theory. But instead of choosing between biology and society, I am saying that romantic love is ancient biological machinery embodying a modern social role. This gives us a slightly more complicated answer to the question of whether our aliens really fall in love. The answer is yes and no. These aliens fall in love at the social level, but not at the biological level. For the dual nature theorist, asking if the aliens fall in love is a bit like looking at two different actors playing Hamlet and asking if they're the same guy. Here too, the answer is yes and no, same character, different actor. What if we took things in the other direction, keeping the biology the same but changing the social role? What if someone was in just the right kind of biological state to count as being in love, but was prevented from participating in the social role of romantic love because the role excluded certain people? For this scenario, we don't need to reach for science fiction. Consider, for example, the situation of a lesbian couple in late 19th century England. Suppose they are in love, biologically speaking. The parts of their brains associated with romantic love are active. They are under the influence of oxytocin, dopamine, and so on. But inflexible heteronormative restrictions on the social role of romantic love prevent these biological states from doing what they would otherwise do. They prevent the women from marrying, from expressing affection, except perhaps clandestinely, from parenting together, or from forming a nuclear family. Social norms severely curtail their ability to engage in any of the kinds of bonding associated with romantic love. Anne Beale and Robert Sternberg, the psychologists who defend a social constructionist theory of love, mention this kind of case as an example of how love changes along with the culture of which it is a part. They note that some women in the late 19th and early 20th centuries experienced, and described in their writings, emotionally intense relationships with their female friends, which included physical elements like kisses and caresses. However, they did not classify these as experiences of being in love. At that time, the social role of romantic love simply did not allow for same-sex cases. It wasn't even up for discussion. Romantic love was treated as being obviously and definitively love between the sexes. The social role of romantic love in UK society has since expanded to create room for the inclusion of lesbian romantic love. Since 2014, women in England have been able to marry other women if they choose. While discrimination persists, this represents a huge cultural shift in the social role of love over a couple hundred years. Jailbreak my heart. Knowing a little history teaches us that the social role of love changes over time. It takes more work to understand why and how. When describing 19th century lesbians from our contemporary perspective, we may want to say they were in love because they met all the conditions from our point of view. They were in a state perfectly suited to play the social role of love as it exists here and now. That state just couldn't play the social role of love as it was constructed back then, with its built-in heteronormativity. Since the 19th century, there has not been a biological change to the way queer people work. Society changed, and the social role of love changed within it. Considering 19th century lesbians makes clear, in a way that considering hypothetical aliens doesn't, what is at stake in this process of change. It reveals that we have choices and responsibilities. We can construct love's social role in ways that tend towards exclusion, repression, and oppression, or toward inclusion, expression, and equality. Social constraints can be powerful, but love's biology is powerful too. No amount of determination to construct a social role for love that excluded queer people managed to shut down the biological machinery of queer love. Over time, the biology won out. The social role expanded to become a better fit for love's biological reality. This is one reason why I think it is crucial not to treat romantic love as a purely socially constructed phenomenon. Being able to see the complex back and forth between love's biology and its social role is important for understanding why these changes to the social role of love happen. Why love breaks free from social constraints at the insistence of its biology. Notice, though, that in order to understand the biology of love as a motivation for social change in this way, we need to rid our biological theory of love of the kind of ideology-driven assumptions that would cloud such understanding. The neurochemistry of love, we now know, looks much the same in queer and non-queer lovers. This is part of the biological story of what love is, and it gives us a basis on which to argue for the social inclusion of queer love. But if we had assumed love was restricted to hetero couples as a matter of biological necessity, we might never even have been motivated to research that question. Instead, we would have given ourselves a biological basis for rejecting the social inclusion of queer love without further investigation. People have been excluded from the social role of romantic love for all kinds of reasons. Queerness is one, along with belonging to different social classes, different religions, or different racialized groups. Dubious biology has frequently supplied excuses for such exclusion. And yet, the real biology of love is precisely why none of these exclusive practices is ultimately sustainable. None of these social constraints on the role of romantic love have succeeded in preventing people from experiencing the rushes of adrenaline, dopamine, oxytocin, and so on. People, biologically speaking, keep falling in love, even as they, socially speaking, are denied access to it. You may now be wondering whether, if the biology of love insists like this, that means we should adopt an attitude of biological determinism. That is to say, should we conclude that the biology of love will eventually win out over any efforts we make at the social level to control or constrain it? Lovers gonna love. We can summarize this attitude of biological determinism with the phrase, lovers gonna love. This is shorthand for the idea that love just happens. It is a biological force of nature under no one's control, and so we can't really do anything to change or contain it. If, for example, falling in love makes people obsessive, volatile, or dangerous to themselves or others, or if it makes women better nest makers and men better providers, then that's just how it is. Lovers gonna love. Uncritical biological determinism is a dangerous business. Some people are biological determinists about gender roles, too. They will say that men are biologically more competitive, aggressive, unfaithful, and so on, than women, and nothing can change this because it's just the way men are. They can then use this idea to maintain and justify a status quo in which toxic behaviors get downplayed on the grounds that they are only natural and thus impossible to rein in. In fact, biological determinism about gender and biological determinism about love often go hand in hand. Lovers gonna love tends to line up neatly alongside boys will be boys. At the extreme, versions of both can be deployed to justify or excuse violent crime. The idea of a crime of passion and the related legal defense of provocation have served disproportionately to secure lenience for men who violently killed or injured their adulterous wives and/or the men with whom their wives were being adulterous. The attitudes behind this have a long and sexist history. In England, in the early 18th century, the Lord Chief Justice called sex with another man's wife the highest invasion of property, because women were property, and said that since jealousy is the rage of man, the violent killing of someone caught in the act of committing adultery with one's wife should not count as murder. In his own more graphic words, "If the husband shall stab the adulterer or knock out his brains, that is bare manslaughter." Attitudes have changed to some extent. For example, women are less often explicitly described as property now, at least not out loud, in public by chief justices. In some contexts, the law has changed too, though only quite recently. Since 2010, there is no longer a defense of provocation in UK law. The stated aim of this change was to end the injustice of women being killed by their husband and then being blamed. Canada restricted the provocation defense in 2015 to those situations in which the victim's conduct constituted an indictable offense, punishable by 5 years or more in prison. This conduct must also be of the sort that would deprive an ordinary person of the power of self-control, and the accused must have acted on it on the sudden and before there was time for their passion to cool. Previously, Canadian law required only the second two conditions, which meant in principle that your husband might use legal actions you had every right to perform, such as saying something that made him think you were having an affair, as a partial legal defense for killing you. In the United States, the Model Penal Code does not explicitly use the word provocation, but does permit leniency for killings committed under the influence of extreme mental or emotional disturbance for which there is reasonable explanation or excuse. This has enabled juries to reach verdicts of manslaughter rather than murder in cases where a man killed his wife or girlfriend and claimed extreme mental or emotional disturbance because she had left him, didn't love him, planned a divorce, danced with another man, and so forth. The language of provocation is employed more directly in federal sentencing guidelines by the U.S. Sentencing Commission, which allow that if the victim's wrongful conduct contributed significantly to provoking the offense behavior, the court may reduce the sentence below the guideline range to reflect the nature and circumstances of the offense. Provocation also serves as an excuse for lethal violence against queer men. In England, men who turn violent when confronted with sodomy, especially of a son by another man, have used versions of the provocation defense for centuries. In contemporary cases, gay panic is a legal defense of provocation or the equivalent used to help excuse a straight-identifying man who kills a queer man after the latter has made an unwelcome advance. As law scholar Kyle Kirkup has pointed out, killing someone out of anger specifically inspired by sexual orientation could be construed as a hate crime. Seen in this light, homophobia should be seen not as the basis for a legal defense, but as the opposite, an aggravating factor. Progress on these issues is slow. In 2014, California blocked uses of the gay panic defense and the corresponding trans panic defense, deployed in a similar way to excuse the killing of trans people. The California Penal Code, which allows for a verdict of manslaughter in cases of killing upon a sudden quarrel or heat of passion, was amended to note that the provocation was not objectively reasonable if it resulted from the discovery of, knowledge about, or potential disclosure of the victim's actual or perceived gender, gender identity, gender expression, or sexual orientation, including under circumstances in which the victim made an unwanted, non-forcible romantic or sexual advance towards the defendant. The rest of the United States lacks such protections. The pace of change is glacial because entrenched ways of thinking about human nature, especially when it comes to anything related to love, sex, or romance, are extremely resistant to change. Ingrained attitudes about what lovers are naturally like can be very difficult to remove fully from our non-conscious minds, even if we consciously disagree with them. Meanwhile, romantic relationships continue to be significant sites of deadly violence, disproportionately for women. In 2013 in the United States, among female murder victims whose relationship to the killer was recorded, 36.6% were murdered by their male partners. 245 male murder victims were recorded as being the husband or boyfriend of their killer, while 992 female victims, over four times as many, were recorded as being the girlfriend or wife of their killer. What are we to do with this potentially dangerous lovers-gonna-love attitude that is so strongly associated with excusing violence? We need to tackle every claim about what is hardwired in us with critical thinking and moral judgment. Critical thinking because some of these claims about hardwiring will just be false. And moral judgment because not everything that's natural is a good idea. We cure natural illnesses with artificial medical interventions. We make an effort to rise above our natures when there is good reason. When it comes to feeling angry enough to kill your unfaithful spouse, there is good reason. When it comes to excluding queer people from the social institution of romantic love, there is no legitimate reason at all. In both of these cases, I suspect nature is responsible for far less of what we observe than we've been encouraged to suppose. But we can only figure all this out through the exercise of critical thinking and moral judgment. We have to do that work. Biology isn't any kind of shortcut to an answer. only biology is biology. Straightforward biological theorists of love place everything about love's nature on the biological side. For them, the deterministic thinking of lover's gonna love is always within easy reach. Straightforward social constructionists place everything on the social side. They always have a ready argument against the idea that lover's gonna love. But the dual nature theorist has neither of these simple options. The dual nature theorist must figure out what belongs to the biology of love and what belongs to its social script. She can acknowledge that societies will never eradicate the biology of love in queer people just by excluding them from love at the social level, while simultaneously challenging the idea that male murderers should be treated leniently provided they were sufficiently enraged by their partner's behavior. I find it helpful to bear in mind the slogan, "Only biology is biology." That's a tautology, of course, but it is also a way of focusing one's mind on this question of what really belongs on the biological side of the ledger and what doesn't. The brain chemistry of queer love does. Lenient sentencing for violent murderers does not. When Helen Fisher claims that, as a matter of biological fact, romantic love evolved because our bipedal female ancestors were needy and had their hands full of babies, we should bear in mind that only biology is biology. Associations between romantic love and female neediness may well turn out to fall on the social side of the ledger. The history of love is littered with attempts to attribute to nature what are really social prejudices. A trial judge, whose ruling was appealed all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, resulting in the landmark case Loving v. Virginia, which in 1967 overturned anti-miscegenation laws in the United States, had infamously attributed the prohibition of interracial marriage to the natural order of things, which, in turn, he attributed to divine will. Almighty God created the races, white, black, yellow, Malay, and red, and he placed them on separate continents. And, but for the interference with his arrangement, there would be no cause for such marriage. The fact that he separated the races shows that he did not intend for the races to mix. In reality, the prohibition of interracial marriage is a chapter in the story of love's social role. Attempts to claim otherwise may look laughable now, but they are not ancient history. It was only in the mid-1990s that the approval rate for marriage between blacks and whites climbed to over 50%. Disappearing love. There is a persistent idea that romantic love should unite two people of the same kind, with the exception of gender. This has been an important aspect of the social role of romantic love, and in some contexts it still is. The role has often built in restrictions to exclude love between people from different social classes, different religions, different racialized groups, and so on. In 2001, clinical psychologist Maria Root published Love's Revolution, Interracial Marriage, based on analysis and interviews with around 200 participants. Root's discussion gives us clues as to how social attitudes to both interracial and same-sex relationships contribute to constructing the social role of romantic love. Although the two cases are different in many important ways and intersect to create situations that are different again, Root notices an important similarity. Among participants in her study, both kinds of relationships led to legal consequences or the invocation of religion as a higher moral authority. And both were often dismissed as merely sexual, as a way to undermine their legitimacy and potential for success and happiness. Here, Root puts her finger on a common strategy for undermining the legitimacy and viability of any relationship that challenges the prevailing ideologies: the refusal to acknowledge love. Love's social role is to take adult attraction and affection and output something resembling a stable nuclear family unit. Where there is resistance to the formation of family-like bonds between queer people or between people racialized into different groups, there is a corresponding resistance to the idea of romantic love between such people. This can take the form of mere disapproval, but even more powerfully, it can take the form of denials that such love is so much as possible. This then leads to the conclusion that any queer or interracial relationship must really be a matter of sexual attraction alone. Because of negative attitudes towards sex in general, this incurs disapproval and disrespect. The desired, and likely, consequence is that under such pressure and without the normal social supports, the relationship will be unable to fulfill the social function of creating a stable family unit. In terms of Beale and Sternberg's social constructionism, explored back in Chapter 2, we can identify this as one of society's regulative mechanisms for stamping out disfavored manifestations of love. In order to fully understand these refusals to acknowledge love, we need to appreciate their significance in terms of what love is, i.e., what love does, at the social level. Sometimes denials of love are obvious and deliberate, explicitly overriding what the lovers themselves say. Family members may simply tell a queer or interracial couple that they aren't in love, that it's just lust, confusion, or the work of Satan. There are also subtler, more insidious ways of making love disappear, just by failing to acknowledge its very possibility. But they all serve the same end, averting disruptions to the current social structure. Changing love means changing our social world, and as such, will always be unwelcome in many quarters. By looking at the recent history of interracial love and queer love, we can identify some major changes to romantic love's social role and corresponding disruptions to prevailing social arrangements. There have been and will be others, but these are enough to draw our attention to an important conceptual question. If the role of romantic love defines what romantic love is at the social level, then shouldn't any change to the role mean that romantic love gets destroyed and replaced with something else? How can romantic love be one thing over time if it is under constant construction and reconstruction? Well, many things, indeed most things, change over time while remaining one and the same thing. You, for example, can change your hair color or your opinions without becoming a different person. Change is normal and doesn't always amount to replacing one thing with another. It's no different for socially constructed things. Take the game of soccer, for example. It is a social construct. We make it what it is by deciding on its rules and traditions. Yet the game of soccer can clearly change over time, acquiring different rules. We still think of it as one and the same game that persists throughout these changes. So why exactly do we say soccer is a single game that has changed over time as opposed to one that is destroyed and replaced with a different game every time there is a rule change? It's because of two factors. First, the changes are small and happen gradually, not in huge leaps. Second, these small gradual changes take place against a background of constancy. At any given time, the majority of the rules of soccer aren't changing, and this allows for some adjustments at the edges. The same goes for the social role of romantic love. We couldn't replace every aspect of love's social role at once and still count it as the same phenomenon we had before, but we can make small gradual changes against a background of constancy. This is then love evolving, not being destroyed and replaced. We should predict that romantic love will continue to change, as it always has. One person, book, or movie won't change the social role of love overnight. The changes will be gradual, but they will happen. And this is one reason why understanding the dual nature of love is so important. Armed only with an understanding of love's biology, we are liable to conceive of love as a natural, objective, and unchanging thing over which we have relatively little influence. This strips us of the conceptual resources to predict and responsibly plan for the ways love is going to change at the social level. So we end up stumbling through those changes without awareness. On the flip side, armed only with an understanding of love as a social construct, we would lack valuable insights into the kinds of changes that might actually work and represent a better fit, given the kinds of creatures we are. For instance, we might want to affect social change so that we came to collectively represent romantic love as the kind of thing one can just snap out of when a relationship ends, instead of experiencing months of heartbreak. But the biological reality is that many people undergo significant chemical changes in their brains when bonding romantically with others, and these have profound and lasting effects. Making these biological love bonds cancelable at will just by altering our social norms isn't an option. Our biology puts some limits on what social change can achieve and gives us clues as to when and how such change can succeed. In the future, we may find ways of interfering with the biology of love directly, using drugs or more radical interventions. I'll have more to say about that later. But we won't find a way to circumvent the vitally important work of understanding love's dual nature. Only by appreciating this duality can we hope to figure out, when love is going wrong, whether the problems stem from society, biology, or a failure of fit between the two. This work must be done because, as things stand, romantic love is failing us in multiple ways. Let's take a look at some of them. Chapter 6. What needs to change? I strain my heart, I stretch my hands, and catch at hope. Christina Rossetti, De Profundis. Abjectly obedient women and other sweet love stories. They say that love and marriage go together like a horse and carriage. The horse-drawn carriage resulted from artificially harnessing a biological organism to an invented technology. The pairing was a success because it suited certain purposes that people had in a particular social context at a particular period in history. Times have changed, though. Nowadays, horses and carriages are rarely seen together. Carriages have evolved into cars. As for the biological half of the pairing, it hasn't changed much. Horses are still pretty much just horses, relieved of their carriage-pulling duties. At a particular period in history, for certain purposes, some societies harnessed romantic love to traditional marriage. I put scare quotes around traditional here because it only recently became traditional in European culture to marry for love. Marriage was more traditionally a property transaction, in which a man gave a woman to another man. This doesn't mean love in marriage was unknown, of course. Love can arise even in relationships that began as property transactions. But we should be wary of reading too much romance into apparently adorable stories of spousal love from a bygone age. In the marriage book, Lisa Grunwald and Stephen Adler present one such story, which they describe as one of the most extraordinary gifts of inspiration. It is a story told by a Roman man in his eulogy for his wife. He describes their excellent marriage, his affection for his wife, and his grief at her death. The centerpiece of the story is that because the couple was childless, this most dutiful of wives offered to divorce her husband and even to bring him another woman to have children with. She is assumed to be the infertile member of the couple. She would then help raise these children, taking on the duties and loyalty of a sister and mother-in-law. What a striking act of loving self-sacrifice, we're invited to think. But on closer evaluation, we might notice how much the eulogy emphasizes the wife's loyalty and obedience. These are the first entries in a long list of her domestic virtues. And we might notice that the husband has a temper, which he says flared up such that I almost lost control of myself when she offered to find him another woman. In fact, his loss of control in the face of extreme emotion is a recurring theme in the eulogy. He also mentions that owing to his wife's death, he is subject to grief that wrests away his power of self-control. We only have one perspective on this relationship. The husband was clearly pleased with it. We are left to wonder what the wife might have said if she could speak to us without worrying what would happen if her husband heard her and lost control of his emotions again. I hesitate to call a relationship explicitly grounded in the obedience and abject self-sacrifice of one of its members an inspirational example of ancient romantic love. It is, in fact, a salutary reminder of how ancient gender stereotypes somehow look more acceptable when we see them through the rose-tinted lens of a sweet love story. If we unthinkingly recycle and romanticize the idea that abject obedience is the highest virtue of a woman in love, we facilitate women's abuse and oppression within romantic relationships. The gender stereotype that infuses this Roman man's conception of a good wife is still with us thousands of years later. It is an aspect of the social role of romantic love that needs to change. If you liked it, then you should have put a ring on it and earned more than her. In our own era, romantic love is so strongly associated with marriage that in 2015, the US Supreme Court's ruling on marriage equality was announced in phrases like "love just won," President Barack Obama's Facebook status update on the day, and "love wins," which quickly became a top trending hashtag on Twitter. An alien visiting Earth could reasonably have concluded that love and marriage are basically the same thing around here. Indeed, the language of the Supreme Court ruling confirms this impression. "No union is more profound than marriage, for it embodies the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. Marriage embodies a love that may endure even past death. The hope of the petitioners in this case is not to be condemned to live in loneliness, excluded from one of civilization's oldest institutions. They ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law. The Constitution grants them that right." This passage can sound sweet at first glance, but look again and you see how the alternative to marriage, i.e. the alternative to love, is a life of loneliness. That message is dark, and it is not subtle. When we celebrate this statement as a beautiful piece of contemporary wisdom, we demonstrate once again that we are willing to swallow quite disturbing ideas, provided they are packaged for us in sweet love stories. It's true that in some parts of Europe and North America, living in sin with a partner to whom one is not married is nowhere near as stigmatized as it was in Bertrand Russell's day. But the idea that love is supposed to lead to marriage is still a central feature of contemporary social life, as will be familiar to anyone who has seen a few rom-coms, felt the pressure of families asking, "When are you two going to get married?" or understood what Beyoncé meant when she said, "If you liked it, then you should have put a ring on it." The assumption that love and marriage are basically the same thing, or would be if you were doing life right, is damaging to the people who are in love and still unable to marry, who are in love and have no wish to marry, and who are married but receive only abuse from their spouses. This normative conflation of love with marriage is another aspect of the romantic love role that needs to change. This is not a wholly separate problem from the gender stereotyping. In fact, the two are intimately connected. For the last couple of hundred years, romantic love has been supposed to lead not just to marriage, but to a particular gendered marital arrangement. The husband works outside the home and participates in public life, while the wife provides free, unlimited childcare and domestic labor. These are not dead stereotypes. In hetero marriages, women are still held responsible for the majority of childcare and housework by default, even if they also work outside the home. Women do significantly more housework across the board than men do. Men face a corresponding default expectation that they will provide financially. In a 2015 paper in the Quarterly Journal of Economics, Marion Bertrand, Emir Kamenitsa, and Jessica Pan illustrate the tenacity of the idea that a wife should not earn more than her husband. They analyze income data from the United States, ranging from 1970 to 2011. In the data for 1970, the wife's earnings very commonly made up less than 10% of household income. From 1980 onward, the share of household income earned by the wife expanded to be pretty much anything provided it was below 50%. Even in the most recent data, covering the 2008 to 2011 period, it is quite unusual for the wife to earn more than half the household income. If the wife does earn more than half, she most likely brings in only slightly more. Hetero-married couples seem strongly resistant to arrangements in which the wife earns significantly more than the husband. The gender pay gap reinforces this status quo. In the United States, women on average earn 78 cents for every dollar earned by a man. Worse still, Bertrand and her co-author's analysis of the data indicates that the few wives who do earn more than their husbands also tend to do more of the housework and childcare than their husbands. They take on a second shift when they get home. The authors hypothesize that this represents an attempt to compensate for the threat they pose to gender roles. Perhaps unsurprisingly, in the light of this, they also find that these arrangements lead to lower marital satisfaction and a greater likelihood of divorce. Gendered assumptions about how a romantic relationship is supposed to look can have a significant impact on our lives, even if we don't notice it. One fascinating study by psychologists Laurie Redman and Jessica Heppen found that women who thought of their romantic partners in terms of chivalry and heroism, i.e. as knights in shining armor, were on average less interested in pursuing high-status occupations for themselves and less ambitious when it came to earnings, education, and leadership goals. Men's romantic associations did not exhibit any such correlation. But here's the thing. Only the women's implicit, unstated, and possibly unconscious associations predicted lowered ambition, not their explicit romantic fantasies. Rudman and Heppen conclude that their research confirms the existence of a glass slipper effect. Socialization into romantic gender norms leaves women's ambitions tottering and limping along, but operates below the level of conscious awareness. It is hard to see the glass slippers on our own feet. Saving Love from Itself with Simone de Beauvoir. Feminist philosophers have been discussing romantic love's connections to gender for a long time. In The Woman in Love, a chapter in her 1949 book The Second Sex, Simone de Beauvoir makes the case that patriarchal romantic love encourages women to seek self-annihilation through absorption into the identity of a male partner. For de Beauvoir, an existentialist, this is anathema to an authentic life. Importantly, though, de Beauvoir believed the damaging gender roles associated with romantic love to be changeable. In her view, they are not hardwired into us as part of our biology, because gender roles in general are not hardwired. De Beauvoir was an intellectual pioneer in developing the idea that gender roles are socially constructed. I want to build on that idea by saying that in the process of constructing gender roles, we're simultaneously constructing some of romantic love's contours. As a result, love itself is gendered at the social level. Strong patterns emerge in the composite image of love, prescribing different experiences of love for women and for men. Of course, in some instances, individuals engage in gender role reversal, but the fact that there is a reversal shows that the gender roles are there and ready to be reversed. De Beauvoir thought that romantic gender roles could be transformed into something more positive. Shulamith Firestone, a later feminist author, was not so optimistic. In her 1970 book, The Dialectic of Sex, Firestone called romantic love, love corrupted by its power context, and a diseased form of love, intended to reinforce the power imbalance between men and women. As she saw it, advances in civilization were destroying the biological basis for that power imbalance, so it had become necessary to shore it up with social institutions. Firestone thought romantic love was one such institution, along with the patriarchal nuclear family. For this reason, she called romanticism a cultural tool of male power to keep women from knowing their condition. She thought it was unsalvageable. Even today, harmful gender stereotypes are associated with romantic love. Should we conclude, with Firestone, that romantic love is unsalvageable? Or should we follow de Beauvoir in thinking it can become something better? I'm with de Beauvoir here. Social constructs are real, but they are also dynamic. In fact, looking back at Firestone's work gives us some traction on this point. Firestone defined romantic love as love between the sexes. This was not unusual in the 1970s and earlier. But the social construction of romantic love has already moved on to the point where this definition looks overly narrow. Same-sex love is now much more likely to be included. Like the normative connection between love and marriage, romantic love's association with heteronormativity has been connected to its reinforcement of gender roles. If it's not necessary for love to involve one woman and one man, how can it be necessary for it to involve one stereotypically womanly woman and one stereotypically manly man? In fact, seen in the right light, heteronormativity is just a form of romantic gender stereotyping. The script for romantic love used to have two clearly defined roles for two clearly defined genders. Start to question that, and you simultaneously challenge both heteronormativity and sexist assumptions about romance. It's a two-for-one deal. Still, it takes time and effort, not to mention luck and good timing, to change anything about the social role of romantic love. Persuading people to part with their cherished ideas about it is hard. But any progress is exciting, and we have witnessed some relatively rapid change of late. Large-scale moves toward the inclusion of same-sex love have happened around me in my lifetime, and comparable moves toward the inclusion of interracial love were happening in the lives of the generation before me. Philosophical reflection on love's nature is timely precisely because romantic love is in a period of such overhaul. Right now, we are poised to learn the lesson that love can change dramatically at the social level. Armed with that information, we can begin to identify what still needs to change, and we can get to work. Romantic gender stereotyping, the heteronormativity that still lingers, and the assumption that love should lead to marriage are high on the list, and they're all interconnected. One crucial first step towards positive change is appreciating that romantic love is not straightforwardly an individual or private matter. You cannot close the doors of a home around a romantic relationship and imagine that this prevents society from intruding. On the contrary, we bring it right in with us. We literally bring into our homes the rom-coms, romance novels, poetry, and myriad other representations that contribute to our composite image of what love is. We figuratively bring in all the expectations for a normal relationship that we have been absorbing ever since we joined in playground renditions of the K-I-S-S-I-N-G rhyme. Taking charge, consciously, of the possibilities for change requires that we first appreciate the sense in which it takes a village to fall in love. All else being equal. I have been able to watch the composite image of romantic love change over my lifetime. Representations of queer love have become much more common and much closer to normal, and as a result, heteronormativity is no longer such a strong emergent contour in the composite image. Even so, internalized heteronormativity is hard to shift, which I can attest to on a personal level. I was over 30 before I noticed a strange disparity. I was dating women and men, and had an online dating profile that mentioned that I was attracted to women, but it had never occurred to me to update my profile or my self-conception to anything other than straight. Once I noticed the disparity, I found it funny, but the point is I did not notice it for a long time. I had been so strongly conditioned to assume I was straight that I kept doing so, even in the face of fairly compelling evidence to the contrary. Although we live in interesting times when it comes to love's social role, change happens against a backdrop of continuity. This continuity is not necessarily a bad thing, and it's part of what makes romantic love one thing over time, something that persists through change rather than being destroyed and replaced. But it means that efforts to include same-sex love have often involved emphasizing that doing so helps promote other romantic norms, especially the norm of monogamy. Monogamy is currently a central feature in the social role of romantic love. That role is about harnessing adult affection and attraction into stable nuclear family units, which have a two-person nucleus. One effective strategy in arguing for the inclusion of queer love has been to show that romantic love can perform its social function better if it gets to work on the affection and attraction between two queer folks, as well as that between two straight ones. It can output more monogamous nuclear family units that way, leaving fewer potentially disruptive instances of attraction and affection that fall outside its remit. Emphasizing the existence and moral rights of same-sex monogamous couples who are a relatively good fit for the current romantic love role opened up the possibility of making this small change while maintaining and even enhancing the other elements of love's social function. For this reason, progress toward the inclusion of same-sex love has often been premised on emphatic assurances of the continued exclusion of polyamory. This is another thing that needs to change. Stigma against non-monogamous love is pervasive and unreasonable. Psychologist Terry Conley and co-authors recently conducted a study that found monogamous relationships were rated more positively than CNM, consensual non-monogamous relationships, on every dimension, including with respect to factors wholly irrelevant to monogamy. For example, they found that monogamous individuals are perceived as being more likely to floss daily and reliably walk their dogs than individuals in consensual non-monogamous relationships. Across all studies, they report, the results consistently demonstrated stigma surrounding CNM and a halo effect surrounding monogamy. However, this kind of halo effect is not always obvious to the people who enjoy its benefits. In a conversation about why she felt it was important to do this research, Conley describes how people would tell her monogamy was really the stigmatized option. They said, well, in Hollywood, non-monogamy is all people do, so it's monogamy that's stigmatized. I always think that's such a crazy situation when the dominant group actually thinks it's being persecuted. Whatever is true in Hollywood, most of us do not live there. For us, the stigma and social rejection that surround non-monogamy carry costs that are hard to count. My boyfriend's father refuses to talk to him about anything except the weather until he breaks up with me. We've been together for years and I've never met any of his family. But rejection is not the only problem. If I had children, I'd be concerned that my poly relationships could be used as grounds for taking them away from me. I often wonder whether it would be legal for someone to fire me or refuse to let me stay at a hotel or incite violence against me on the grounds that I have two romantic partners. I'm happy to say those things haven't happened to me, but when I've discussed my relationships in popular media, I've received enough anonymous feedback wishing bad things on me to make me conscious of safety issues. Moreover, in many parts of the world, adultery is illegal. In some, it is punishable by death. In the United States, at least, anti-adultery laws are rarely enforced, but it's not exactly comfortable to know that I could be a criminal in the United States when I only wanted to be a tourist. All the stigma surrounding non-monogamous relationships has given queer activism a strong pragmatic reason to distance itself from non-monogamy and promote a narrative of queer love that very closely resembles traditional monogamous romance. Queer poly people are particularly at risk in this dynamic, becoming liable to be told that they are ruining gay marriage for everybody and excluded from queer communities on top of already facing multiple forms of stigmatization. The rush to keep romantic love monogamous is not restricted to queer activism, of course. It has been joined from all sides. Social conservatives are motivated to join by the sentiment behind Jean-Luc Picard's famous ultimatum, the line must be drawn here, this far, no further. U.S. conservative Eli Lera wrote a HuffPost blog post in 2013 that appeared under the not overly subtle headline, Gay Marriage Good, Polyamory Bad. In it, Lera explains that gay marriage is, at the very worst, neutral for society, while polyamory is pretty clearly harmful to society. The article is hard to read in a number of ways. Lera is the kind of writer who will drop in a phrase like, handful of backward Muslims, without missing a beat. More relevant for current purposes, though, is what Lera thinks polyamory is. In one revealing passage, he says, polyamorous societies will, by definition, never have enough mates to go around. He adds, always and everywhere, this has resulted in significant numbers of disaffected heterosexual males who have no hope of finding a mate. By definition? Lera is thinking of patriarchal polygamy, in which men can have multiple wives but the reverse arrangement is not permitted. The people he refers to as mates are, to be more accurate, women. It is simply not on Lera's radar that women could ever have multiple partners. This mistake alone means that Lera's argument makes no contact with its purported target. He is not discussing polyamory, he is discussing patriarchal polygamy. When Lera considers whether there are enough mates to go around, he concludes that leaving distribution to the free market would inevitably lead to some men not receiving their share. His concern is that those men will become disaffected and then, presumably, bash things or upset the social order. The argument is not original to Lera. It is a perennial trope. I'm not interested in the failed argument per se, but in the attitudes to gender that are revealed when people discuss monogamy in these terms. There are a number of issues to untangle. First, Lera seems to think that men who are romantically frustrated are a terrible and dangerous force of nature that no one can or should control. Perhaps I'm overly optimistic, but I don't think this is justified. I give men more credit than that. I think they are capable of self-control. And I don't assume violence is the inevitable consequence when they don't get the women they want or feel they deserve. In addition to the misandry, there's a strange conception of women, or mates, as a kind of property or commodity that ought to be distributed among hetero men in an equitable manner. Only once one is thinking of women that way could it make sense to think of there not being enough to go around. Only then could one countenance the legal enforcement of a redistributive policy that would interfere with individual liberty. Another well-known redistributive policy, structurally parallel to Lehrer's, maintains that we shouldn't permit significant financial inequality. After all, financially inegalitarian societies will, by definition, never have enough money to go around. Always and everywhere, this has resulted in significant numbers of disaffected people who have no hope of acquiring wealth. Should we conclude that, because of the damage the disaffected poor may do to the fabric of society, the state should intervene to limit how much wealth any one individual may acquire? This would radically interfere with individual liberty, of course. But Lehrer seems to think that serious state intervention is appropriate to ensure a proper distribution of resources in such situations. This analogy helps highlight the fundamental mistake behind the argument. Wealth may or may not be a commodity suitable for state redistribution, but women definitely are not. In untangling this kind of philosophical mess, that is the most important thread to pull on. The rest of it unravels as soon as we do that. The status of sluts. While we're on the subject of money, wealth and social class are themselves important for understanding romantic love's social function. For a number of reasons, people are more likely to choose romantic partners of a similar socioeconomic status, especially education level, to their own. Major changes to this norm would present destabilizing risks to a society, as widespread love-based marriage across status divisions would encourage greater social mobility, as well as serve to highlight the arbitrariness and injustice of status distinctions in the first place. Nevertheless, it has long been accepted that romantic love can, in exceptional cases, cross barriers of class, wealth, and status. This idea might be as old as romantic love itself. Cinderella-like folktales have been around for centuries at least. Notice, though, that the genders in the Cinderella story are a big part of its romantic appeal. High-status women who marry low-status men are not viewed in quite the same light. The social institution of morganatic marriage, in which a lower-status spouse and any offspring of the marriage are prohibited from inheriting property and/or titles from a higher-status spouse, attempts to alleviate some of the destabilizing impacts of love between partners of very different status. The rate at which people marry outside their own social class varies with time and circumstance, but the basic idea that love can conquer all has never really gone away. In some ways, it has served as a model for love conquers all narratives in other arenas, such as interracial and same-sex love. Class status also has subtler influences on how romantic love works. For example, it affects the ways in which one is liable to be penalized for violating romantic norms. Sociologists have recently studied the relationship between slut-shaming and social class amongst college women, finding that high-status women would call low-status women slutty in order to assert class advantage and define themselves as classy rather than trashy. Violations of the norm of romantic monogamy are commonly policed via the mechanism of slut-shaming. The findings of this study thus suggest that violating the norm of monogamy is likely to carry a lesser penalty for those protected by higher social class. It also carries a higher penalty for women than for men. I call this the slut versus stud phenomenon. It's not hard to come up with a long and colorful list of words that specifically denigrate promiscuous women. But what words denigrate promiscuous men? A rake or cad sounds like the dashing antihero in a P.G. Wodehouse story. A playboy or player sounds like somebody who has a lot of fun. A pimp is a man who controls or manages sex workers, not someone who is himself promiscuous. I've never heard anyone use the word gigolo in real life. Man whore is an explicitly masculinized version of a feminine word. Womanizer might be the best candidate, but while derogatory, it lacks the vitriolic punch of slut, partly because it points to an activity rather than an identity. And I don't know of any words generally used to praise promiscuous women in a manner comparable to the way stud is used for men. The use of slut-shaming to penalize women, especially lower-status women, for perceived failures of monogamy is a blunt weapon. The concept of sluttiness targets only sex, not love or relationships. In fact, however, this makes it all the more effective because it serves to reinforce the idea that non-monogamous relationships don't count as love. They are really just sex. This is a common strategy for making disfavored forms of love disappear, thus reinforcing the exclusive contours of love's social role. With any movement that aims to make romantic love more inclusive at the social level, there is a threat to social stability. In addition to the general instability associated with change of any kind, love has a special place in defining who we think we are and how we think we should live. Expanding the social role of romantic love to include interracial relationships is highly destabilizing to a social order that is rigidly segregated on racial lines. The inclusion of same-sex love, and more generally, challenging established romantic gender roles, is similarly destabilizing to a social order that expects wives to provide domestic labor for husbands who work outside the home. Non-monogamous love is interestingly different, however. It poses distinctive destabilizing risks that strike directly at the heart of romantic love's social function, whatever kind of social order it is embedded within. If the social role of romantic love allowed for polyamorous love, it could obviously become much less effective at performing its core function of channeling affection and attraction into stable, nuclear family-like units. Many kinds of queer and interracial love can be brought to fit the mold of the nuclear family. Others can't, but these have been successfully downplayed in the push for greater acceptance. With poly love, it's just too obvious that many or most forms cannot be squeezed into the confines of the nuclear mold. While some poly people form nuclear families, polyamory encompasses infinite possible configurations, and many of them blatantly fail to conform to anything like the nuclear model. First comes love, then comes marriage, then comes baby in a baby carriage. Because change happens against a backdrop of continuity, the inclusion of same-sex love in the social role of romantic love has been promoted by reaffirming the norm of monogamy. A parallel, but even less visible phenomenon has been the reaffirmation of amatonormativity, introduced earlier as the idea that romantic love is ideal and a default for everyone, as part of the backdrop to this change. Just like normative monogamy, amatonormativity can be deployed to help show how romantic love can better accomplish its social role if we make a relatively small change to include same-sex cases. Here, the thought is that we can more successfully prescribe romantic love as the ideal state for everyone if we allow for same-sex love. That way, those for whom hetero love is not an option can still be expected to conform to amatonormative pressure. Recall how the U.S. Supreme Court ruling on same-sex marriage snuck in the message that the alternative to marriage is to be condemned to live in loneliness. Once again, predictably, amatonormativity impacts differently according to gender. While men may aspire to the status of confirmed bachelor, women are given the prospect of being a crazy old cat lady. Even the simple word spinster suggests a dull, sexless woman who is probably deeply weird in some way. If you're lucky, Miss Marple. If you're unlucky, Miss Havisham. Amatonormativity is so common that it usually passes unremarked. Even extreme versions of it won't so much as raise an eyebrow. And I don't just mean in cafe conversations, rom-coms, or pop songs, though let's not overlook the powerful messages conveyed in lyrics like "You're nobody till somebody loves you." Casual amatonormativity is routine even in scholarly research. For example, in a recent article discussing the theoretical comparison of romantic love to addiction, Michelle Renaud and co-authors describe love passion as a universal and necessary state for human beings. Note the wording. Passionate love is not just common, it is universal. And it's not just nice, but also necessary. Now imagine, or perhaps this is already true of you and you don't have to imagine, that you have not been in love and you have no plans to be. You are happy in your relationships with your family and friends and community, and you don't think romantic love is something you want in your own life. These scientists, in a single sentence, have both theorized you out of existence and classified your life as inadequate. Amatonormativity is so pervasive as to be more or less invisible, except to the people it most directly affects. For everyone else, it's become like wallpaper. However strange and ugly the pattern is, it's there every minute of every day. If you have no reason to notice it, you won't. If we truly want to permit and respect a diversity of life choices, we need to work at removing amatonormativity from our composite image of romantic love. But just as with monogamy, any challenge to amatonormativity poses a distinctive destabilizing risk that goes to the heart of romantic love's social function. If romantic love works to channel adult affection and attraction into stable nuclear family units, it is necessary to guard against people ending up with either multiple romantic partners or none at all. The former task falls to the norm of monogamy, the latter to amatonormativity. They are like the twin gutters whose job is to keep us all rolling down the same alley toward the same pins. They are also some of the hardest aspects of love's social role to see clearly, precisely because they are some of the most fundamental. Social stability, including the maintenance of privilege by the privileged, is best served by mass unawareness of the deep core of the social machinery that structures our lives and our loves. It is even more effective if we can attribute these deep core norms to nature or biology so that we'll accept them as inevitable. To round off this discussion, let me mention one more aspect of love's current social role that needs to change. At the moment, there are strong normative connections between love and reproduction, specifically the production of biological offspring within a hetero marriage. My experience of becoming a recently married woman in my early 30s came with a widespread expectation that I would soon be having biological kids with my husband. This default expectation that biological kids are on the horizon as soon as love becomes serious, and especially once a couple is married, can cause harm both to adults and to children. It can lead people to have kids simply because it's expected, rather than because it's desired, and it imposes a sense of inadequacy or failure on those who do not want or cannot have biological children. Like all the other issues we've looked at in this chapter, the reproductive norm is gendered too. As Bertrand Russell pointed out back in 1929, though, it's far from obvious that it is gendered the right way around. Russell noticed that people seemed to think women wanted children more than men did. But he said, "My own impression, for what it's worth, is exactly the contrary. A woman, after all, has to face labor and pain and possible loss of beauty in order to bring a child into the world, whereas a man has no such grounds for anxiety." It turns out that statistics confirm his suspicion. Economist Marina Adshead pointed out in a 2015 article in the Globe and Mail that the Statistics Canada General Social Survey has for decades now included data on how Canadians answer the question, "How many children do you plan to have, including the ones that have already been born or you are expecting at this time?" The question was first asked in 1990. Back then, more men than women said they wanted children, regardless of age or marital status. However, by 2011, the percentage of men who didn't want children had almost doubled. Adshead has a hypothesis about this, based on something that never seems to have occurred to Russell as a possibility: men taking responsibility for childcare. Adshead's diagnosis of the data is simply that men have always wanted babies as long as women were willing to make all the sacrifices. Now that those sacrifices are more evenly shared between parents, no one should be surprised to learn that fewer men now want to have children. A more general moral is worth drawing out here. What is normative, in the sense of being socially prescribed, does not have to be statistically normal. Women normatively want children more than men do, but it doesn't follow that this pattern is statistically normal. Likewise, the perfect cereal box nuclear family, the normatively prescribed life choice, is actually a rare thing. Perhaps this shouldn't be surprising. If it were truly natural and desirable for all or even most of us, we would hardly need all these social norms and penalties to channel everyone toward it. Changing the composite image. In my time and place, the social role of romantic love, a composite image that emerges from the overlaying of all our cultural representations, norms, and narratives, builds in some features that are causing harm and need to change. I've reviewed just a few in this chapter. The normative assumption that love should lead to marriage and biological reproduction, the norm of romantic monogamy, amato-normativity, and, permeating all of these while also contributing further harms of their own, the stereotypical gender roles for romantic love. These social norms work together to make romantic love a powerful force for the creation of traditional nuclear family units, causing tangible damage to anyone caught in the crosshairs. The nuclear family model works well for a lot of people. When it succeeds for you and the people you know, it can be nice to imagine that success writ large as a template for everyone's life. In fact, this imaginative projection can be so gratifying that it becomes unsettling and even scary to imagine accepting anything else as normal. But when we get down to it, the nuclear family simply does not have the right to disparage or erase every other model of what a good life can look like. One theme underlies all the changes I'm advocating for here. None of them involves restricting the role of romantic love or excluding anybody from it who is currently included. If you are hetero and monogamous and want a completely traditional marriage, then I say go for it. The social role of romantic love should be fully open to you so that you can freely choose that option. In fact, you can only ever choose that option freely if the norms that force your hand are dissolved. If traditional is the only flavor of relationship readily available to you, ending up with it isn't exactly a choice. It's more like Henry Ford's fabled offer of a Model T in any color so long as it's black. In the next chapter, I turn to the future of love by way of some of its history. We are constantly adding more and more layers to our composite image of what love is. Old layers are fading out. We could ultimately dissolve each of the damaging features of love's social role, if we wanted to. But even granting that these changes to the social role of love are individually possible, could we really make all of them? Would there be anything left of romantic love if we did that? And while all this was going on at the social level, what could or should we do about love at the level of biology?